Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our In the News pod, which we do every couple of weeks. And with me, as usual, I've got our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And I've got our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds.
Hello.
Adrian. Now, Adrian, fresh from the Hub Conference a couple of weeks ago,
our conference
for those training for ministry. Yeah. How did that go?
Well, we had a great time. We had a good number of people there. We had people who are thinking about ministry just at very early stages. We have people who are training for ministry. And it's just great to spend time with folks like that who are eager to serve in the church, some of whom will go into paid positions, some of whom will serve in other capacities in churches. But it's just very energizing to meet younger generation of leaders or potential leaders. It is a reminder, though, that there is a great need for raising up leaders that won't be met just by the numbers who are coming along at the Hub. It's interesting if you look on our jobs pages on the website at the moment, or indeed, if you were to go through my inbox, were you to have that privilege, or I don't know, but no, it's not a privilege.
Nobody else does.
You would just find lots of emails, lots of people saying, you know, we're looking for an assistant, we're looking for a trainee. The churches in the FIEC often are growing. There's a great narrative going on. Churches are wanting to train people up. Smaller churches are grasping the baton when it comes to thinking about, you know, how do we train up a younger generation of leaders? But actually, there are many more positions than there are people to fill them.
Yeah.
So we need to keep on praying to the Lord of the harvest that he would raise up people and keep doing our part in seeking to raise up new leaders.
Encouraging time, John.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a real encouragement of things being back to normal after COVID. I think it was just brilliant to see people beginning to think about going into full-time ministry again. I think inevitably COVID meant that the pipeline of people heading into ministry, churches encouraging people to do that and people taking that step had stopped. And it's just taken a long time for things to recover after COVID, but it is great to see that happening. I was actually at a meeting this week with a gathering of church leaders from a variety of different streams, probably about 20 or so leaders, all of whom were remarking how kind of come the new year after January, things seem to have been very much back to normal. Mm. Sort of the vast majority of people back in church, ministries restarting. And I think for the Hub Conference, that was a real kind of encouragement to us to just be able to sort of see that process beginning again.
Well, one story that's dominated the last couple of weeks, brothers, has been from the Church of England. So this is the latest kind of steps in their living life in love and faith and all the kind of consultation they've been doing there. The bishop's now coming up with proposals to essentially say they will stick with the Orthodox definition of marriage between a man and a woman, but they will offer blessings for those who have had same-sex unions in other contexts. It sounds a little bit inconsistent to me. What's your reaction been to it, first of all?
Well, I mean, it seems extraordinary.
I'm going to let John go first.
I do think actually many Anglicans think that it looks extraordinary.
Yeah. This is of all kinds.
Absolutely. This is the sort of the culmination of a five-year process of consideration. We know that the Church of England is deeply divided between those who want to accept same-sex marriages and for the church to be able to conduct same-sex marriages and others who hold to a biblical conviction, whether from an Anglo-Catholic background or an evangelical background, saying that sort of same-sex relationships are contrary to scripture and sex is only appropriate for kind of marriage. And in some ways, those positions are entirely unreconcilable. And the bishops have been trying to find a way forwards. And what they proposed is a compromise that in the end will satisfy kind of nobody.
Why is that? Why will it satisfy nobody, John?
Well, what they've decided to do is they've decided to say they're not going to change the doctrine of kind of marriage. They're going to continue to take the view that the Church of England formally does at the moment, that marriage is only a heterosexual relationship between a man and a woman. They're saying they're not changing that doctrine, so they're not going to be introducing...
And that sexual activity only belongs within that union.
Yeah. So they're not going to be conducting same-sex weddings. But at the same time, they've wanted to affirm the legitimacy of love between people who are same-sex couples. So they're proposing that individual clergy be allowed to conduct services of blessing for those who've entered into a civil kind of same-sex kind of marriage. And when you look at the prayers that they've produced, they're tantamount to being a marriage service. They involve the exchange of rings. And I think the challenge here is that what those prayers do is they basically affirm these relationships as good and to be celebrated. The Archbishop of York, the Archbishop of Canterbury have been saying that they're glad that these prayers have been introduced. They want to celebrate these relationships. The whole approach is simply theologically, you know, God, love is good, whatever its form, and therefore we've got to celebrate love in all its different kind of forms. So essentially what they've done is they've tried to placate those who would be biblical traditionalists by saying we're not changing the doctrine of marriage, but provide enough for those people who want to introduce same-sex marriage to say that the church is affirming and celebrating their relationships. Of course, that will satisfy neither, because for those who want the church to affirm same-sex relationships, they feel they're still being treated as second class. They're not able to get married kind of in church. For those who hold to the biblical position, this is simply blessing sin. And the case has been made that although the bishops are claiming they're not changing the doctrine of marriage, in effect, by what they've done, they are changing the doctrine of sin by allowing something that at the moment the Church of England says is sinful and wrong to be blessed and celebrated. And they're going to issue new pastoral advice, which seems to affirm the legitimacy of sexual relationships between same-sex couples, potentially to allow clergy in civil same-sex marriages to be able to engage in sexual relationships, where at the moment they are required to be kind of celibate. It seems like a fudge. It's very clear the response from evangelicals and Orthodox Anglicans has been outrage, shock, disbelief, that this could be being proposed with so little kind of theological explanation. Reactions from Church Society, from GAFCON, Global Anglicans. And you see the problem in the kind of, the Archbishop of Canterbury has said that he won't personally bless same-sex relationships because he's a figure of unity for the church. The Archbishop of York has said he will conduct sort of same-sex blessings. And it just seems extremely difficult to see how this can possibly be a workable kind of compromise.
Is it a done deal, John?
It goes to synod, doesn't it?
Well, does it? I don't know. It's slightly confusing, isn't it? The things I've read as to whether actually the synod have to affirm it or is it a doctrinal change that needs a certain supermajority?
From what I understand, the way the bishops are trying to put it forwards is to argue that it doesn't need to go to synod, it doesn't need approval, it's not a doctrinal change, and therefore they're trying to avoid having this something that is voted on, because they know that there isn't a majority in synod, certainly not a two-thirds majority for accepting same-sex relationships. So they've tried to come up with an approach that actually doesn't require synod to approve the kind of position. Of course, there are those who are arguing that synod ought to vote on this, that its opinion ought to be made clear. I think there's another element that because it's not a proposal for change, it doesn't require a majority in all of the houses of synod. Synod is divided into the House of Bishops, clergy and laity. So the bishops cleverly and politically have come up with a way of trying to bring this in without actually requiring the consent of the church as a whole. But I mean, what's so extraordinary about this is bishops who would claim to be evangelicals who are supporting this as a legitimate way forwards and coming out and saying that they are happy with this
unfortunate phrase.
Well, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, extraordinarily, who's always seemed very orthodox on these matters, now saying he's joyful that this is going to be offered. It does seem a bit difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it clearly shows that he is in favour of gay relationships. And, you know, you can't say that you are joyful about blessing and celebrating things that up until now have been regarded as sin unless you've changed your position on that. And we're talking here about the bishops who within an Anglican structure are meant to be those who have promised to uphold the faith of the church, promised to uphold the doctrines of the 39 Articles, the Book of Common Prayer, the Ordinal, and quite how they can square with their conscience and their integrity the promises that they have made before God to uphold biblical doctrine and the official position of the church, and yet then come out and say that they are rejoicing and celebrating basically the blessing of what the church has always regarded as sin, seems to me to be a massive lack of integrity and a complete failure of what it means for those who are meant to have teaching responsibility.
Part of the answer to that, of course, is that they are pursuing unity at all costs. And when you make unity your chief aim, you're always going to get into trouble. And this is a lesson for us as well in church life, that unity, I think it's pretty clear in John 17, unity is derived from truth. We are joined with others because of the things that we have in common, the things we believe in common. That's what makes us brothers and sisters in Christ. But when you make unity structural, or when you make unity itself the chief end and goal, you end up having to compromise in really very hopeless situations. And I think this is it's telling, I think, that the Archbishop of Canterbury describes his role as a focus of unity. And that's what he's trying to do. They're trying to maintain unity in a divided church. And we as evangelicals understand that you can't have unity without truth. That's a hopeless pursuit. And I think that's essentially the bottom line. That's the nub of the problem.
Now, we've got brothers and sisters, haven't we, who are leading Anglican churches.
Yeah, that's right.
Will they have to perform these blessings? Can they opt out of them? So when the Methodist Church brought this in, it was clear that it would be down to the individuals whether they performed these kind of blessings or not. Is that the same, do we understand, for our Anglican friends?
Well, no, it's very clear the bishops have said this is not something you have to do, so it makes it an issue for individual clergy to make a decision. Actually, that's problematic, as kind of Legatus, who leads church society, said that in the end is to sort of devolve these theological judgments to each and every individual kind of parish kind of clergyman. So rather than the bishops and the church making a decision, every individual has to do this.
That sounds like independence.
I was going to say, it sounds like it's evolving it to the local church.
I think the challenge there, I mean, there are two things really. You're then part of a church structure that, at least from the outside, seems to have changed its doctrinal position. Do you still want to remain part of that? Can you still subscribe to that? But the other point is that inevitably it seems that the direction of travel is inevitably going to be in favour of ultimately performing and accepting same-sex
relationships.
So you can imagine the situation. Some churches start performing blessings of sort of same-sex civil kind of relationships with a service that looks remarkably like a marriage. Rings are exchanged. No doubt people will be wearing the kind of marriage kind of clothing. It will be a marriage-like celebration. It'll become normalised then within the church. Those that are refusing to do that will then be seen as being odd and out of step. It's already been said they'll review the position in 5 years' time. Can anybody see that in 5 years' time they could possibly decide to withdraw the blessings of these relationships? So the direction of travel is clear, and it's the frog in the kind of the water, kind of gradual step-by-step bringing to the boil, never doing enough to force people to kind of think that they've got to leave at that moment, offering them the fact that they've still got kind of choice and the official doctrine hasn't changed. But the direction of travel is absolutely clear.
Is it, sorry, go on.
I think what, something that's perhaps worth us reflecting on is how does a church get to this position? And how does this happen? Because people might ask that. And I think there are a number of things that all of us can learn from this. Church has got to this position by failing to discipline its own doctrinal standards for decades. So basically the reason that this happens is clergy and bishops are appointed, given power in the church, and actually they don't agree with the 39 articles, they don't agree with biblical doctrine, they are opposed to it. And if a church fails to exercise its own disciplinary standards against its own clergy, its own leaders, even its own members, then in the end, a consensus will be built for change. So the church is undermined from the inside. And that's why it's so important that churches maintain their doctrinal positions, that those who lead sign up to those doctrinal positions, and that is enforced. And the history of how liberalism came into the church, how Catholicism came into kind of Protestant churches, is a total failure to exercise proper church discipline and require people to stand by the official position of the church. So that kind of creeping failure to exercise appropriate boundary sort of protection leads to this ultimate outcome. At the same time, it follows from the fact that lots and lots of churches have chosen not to teach on these issues. So even within those that are evangelical, many have steered clear of talking about issues of sexuality. So a generation of people have been brought up without being taught biblical truth. They've been taught the gospel, the positives of the gospel, but not the negatives of the gospel and not the implications of the gospel. And it's not surprising that then those that have been brought up without having those things taught find it very difficult to stand kind of firm. And then thirdly, it's the pressure of the wider culture, the idea that the church has got to fit with the culture and that somehow missionally, only if we're like the culture will the church be acceptable. And the idea that large numbers of people are not coming to church because of its positions on gay relationships and same-sex marriage seems sort of unbelievable. People have been abandoning church for the better part of 50, 60 years. And all the evidence is that it's the churches that are standing firm on biblical sexuality that are growing. Those that have compromised already are rapidly declining. But those three kind of factors, not disciplining your boundaries, not teaching the truth on sexuality for fear of what people will think, and thinking that you have to fit in with the culture, in the end devastate churches.
Phil, can I just nibble at this biscuit from a different side? Because I wonder if one of the questions for us as leaders in, I guess, most of our listeners broadly in independent churches, or non-conformist perhaps, I wonder if one of the questions that we have to wrestle with is, what do we make of it all? And it's very easy to sit on the sidelines and be critical. And there's a place for friendly critique, I think. And I'm an independent by conviction. I'm not in independent ministry because it just happens to be the place I've ended up. I'm not a pragmatist in that sense. So I could happily attend, I think, an Anglican church if I was a member and it happened to be the local evangelical church and that's the church that was. I couldn't be a leader in an Anglican church. I couldn't be a vicar. I don't think that's not my conviction about what the Bible teaches. So at that point, we who have firm convictions about ecclesiology might look at the Anglican church and our number one response to what is going on is to be critical and to kind of have a sort of I told you so attitude. And I think right at the moment that's really unhelpful. I think we've got to think clearly, how do we stand with Anglican brothers and sisters? And the town where you're ministering, there may be an Anglican evangelical church, might not be exactly the same stripe of evangelicalism, but there's an Anglican evangelical in your town who's seeking to be faithful and is wrestling with what to do. Do you just kind of keep your head down? Do you stand up? And I think we've got to be very careful of saying, well, of course you have to leave. That's the only option. And making it very difficult for actually people who are going through essentially an existential crisis about identity and ecclesiology, especially if they are not just pragmatists themselves. You know, a lot of people in Anglican ministry, I think, did go into Anglican ministry because they believe that the best boat to fish from argument and they are pragmatists. But there are a lot of people, got a great lot of time for them, who are convinced Anglican in their ecclesiology.
And let's not forget, they're leading congregations of people. Indeed. They want to faithfully lead them. Absolutely. They don't just want to step away from that.
And, you know, to leave is huge. There's a huge cost to that in terms of building, in terms of provision, in terms of cost, in terms of training provision that's in the Church of England, in terms of pension. And of course, some will feel that's a price that they have to pay. And we've got to let people work through that and stand with them and pray for them and be an encouragement to them. So I think I want to encourage my own heart as I think about people who are around us and Anglicans I know to say, how can I be praying for you? I had a telephone call just this week with a guy who's a well-known Anglican down in the Southwest that I'm teaching with on Saturday, and just said to him, how can I pray for you? Because and I think rather than say, you know, well, you're wrong about this, you're wrong about that, I do have convictions about what's right and wrong, but this is not the moment, I think, to be throwing stones from the sidelines.
I know many evangelicals of all stripes have been fighting this in the Church of England as well. They are as shocked, as you say, as anybody else. Sorry, John.
I think the Church of England is high profile. It's a national state church within England. I think we need to remember that this has happened in a whole load of other churches ahead of the Anglican Church. In some sense, they are late to making this kind of change. Yeah. Kind of think, for example, the Methodist Church, the URC, the Church of Scotland, then the Church of Wales and the Episcopal Church in Scotland. The Baptist Union failing to exercise discipline against churches conducting sort of gay relationships. So this is a problem not specifically to Anglicanism. This is a problem with a whole range of Christian denominations failing to take a biblical stand issue.
Can I just I'd tap into your lawyer brain for a minute. Should our stand on marriage and sexuality be in our basis of faith for churches?
Well, I think not whether it's in your basis of faith or whether it's in some kind of clear policy statement or constitutional position, yes, I think every church would be advised to have a very clearly agreed position in relation to issues of marriage and same-sex kind of relationships. I think that's really important. I think it's important for a couple of levels. I think it's important because within the contemporary context, many of those who are advocating for accepting same-sex relationships would claim the name evangelical, and they would claim that they believe in scripture. So if you're relying on having simply a church document that says we believe in the final authority of scripture, and you think that means that rules out sort of same-sex relationships, well, if that were ever to come before a court or to be interrogated, there'll be a whole load of people who will say,
well, the Baptist Union has
not,
that
that's
in
not
their
an
very
inevitable
brief basis of faith, don't they?
Consequence. So I don't think we can take for granted that believing the Bible necessarily excludes same-sex relationships. So I think that's really important for our own protection. At the same time, I think every church ought to be honest. And of course, here we want to say not believing that same-sex relationships are right before God is not the same as being homophobic. It's not the same as being unwelcoming to those from an LGBTQ community. We long to connect people. We want to love our neighbours as ourselves. We want to share the good news of the gospel. Common grace, we want to practice those right relationships. At the same time, I think it's really important for churches that we be absolutely honest about where we stand. And in a sense, it's dishonest to encourage people to come in and give them the impression that their behavior is accepted. And then suddenly they discover that actually, no, we have a very different set of beliefs. So I think both for our protection in the legal environment, for our integrity in being clear about who we are and what we believe, particularly where this is a kind of cutting edge issue for churches and in society as a whole, I think some clarity is needed in every local church.
Honesty and integrity, does that lead us to talking about politics?
maybe it does. We could move on, couldn't we, and talk a bit about Nadeem Zahawi's tax affairs.
Oh, let's.
I mean, I was rummaging around the back of the sofa last night. There was a couple of million there. I just hadn't thought about it. I mean, this looks extraordinary, doesn't it? It's a complete, like, it looks like a lack of transparency. And the problem, I think, for the government is this seems to be happening at multiple levels, multiple times in different ways, and it just looks rubbish, doesn't it? Or am I being harsh?
No, I think it does. I mean, it is a complicated story because it's about shares that he didn't actually own in a company that he started and were vested in an offshore trust, and you actually, once you start realizing, you start reading the detail of the story, you realize that that rich people who own businesses very often have very complex tax affairs that are basically highly structured to not, I've got to be careful with my language, but basically to minimize the tax that they pay and to minimize the transparency that there is. You know, so there's a question there about just the integrity of putting your tax affairs offshore and all those sorts of questions. But essentially, this is about someone appointed to a job where he was going to be head of HMRC, the Revenue and Customs, and actually, therefore, in theory, investigating himself. Mm. So there is a question about integrity in leadership. So I think one of the things they're looking at is whether he should ever have been appointed in the first place. Yeah. He should certainly have disclosed what was going on, and if he did disclose it, why was it not a red flag? And those questions are in theory going to be looked at by this investigation.
But it's interesting, HMRC said there's no such thing as an innocent error. That's what they said to MPs yesterday when it comes to tax affairs.
No such thing as an innocent a penalty for innocence. So it's not quite the same.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
And it's complicated because there is, in tax law, so I'm in my specialist.
This is your element. Yeah. You're in your element
there
here,
is in
brother.
Tax
Talk
law,
us through
the
it.
The idea of carelessness.
Yeah.
And that is provided for. But basically, you can't, if you make a genuine error, you have to pay your back tax. You still have to pay the tax, and you have to pay interest, but you don't pay a penalty. Mm. So a penalty is associated with a deliberate error rather than an accidental error.
Good correction.
Sense.
Thank you.
That still can be carelessness. Mm. So there is this sort of slightly grey category in the middle.
I think that raises questions of how we hold people accountable and what we hold them accountable for, because there is a difference between deliberate dishonesty and a kind of a mistake that's an entirely innocent mistake, and then a failure to take reasonable care in the middle. And we don't know all the circumstances of this, but there are shadings of moral responsibility in these kind of situations. Yeah. We could be taken in by the fact that it's the amount that's kind of paid, the 5 million or whatever, just seems huge. But actually, here is somebody who is massively wealthy. I think, you know, the company he founded, he got 150 million from it whatever.
It's huge, isn't it?
So at one level, in terms of his personal wealth, that amount of money is not an extraordinary amount.
Yeah.
But the culpability comes down to that spectrum from deliberate dishonesty through to complete accident and a lack of reasonable care in identifying what his tax liability kind of should have been.
So let's say, for example, I got a loan from a distant family member, a very distant cousin that I didn't really know very well. But because they're a family member, the rules mean I don't have to disclose that loan. You know, where are we there on the shades of integrity? And we're talking about Boris now, obviously, because that's exactly what he did.
That's what he did.
He didn't declare his £800,000 loan from his cousin because the cousin was a distant cousin, although he had to be introduced to the cousin by a third party. That's how well he knew the cousin. But he claimed family linkage and therefore didn't have to be disclosed. So this is the problem, isn't it? We are in a grey area. I think as Christian leaders, we always need to over-disclose. Mm. My personal view is if there are things that are grey in church life, then don't make the judgment yourself. Let others make the judgment about whether they are right to be disclosed or not. And if they decide they are, then you act upon that. And if they decide they're not, then that's fine. But you take that out of your decision. And that's one of the strengths, actually, of a plural leadership, is that you can make some of those decisions together. You're not making them on your own. But I think in Christian leadership, especially when it comes to financial matters, we should always be overly careful and not... to err on the side of caution, essentially, when it comes to disclosures.
I think there's a warning to us generally. There's a danger of being hypocritical as a society. You look at sort of someone like Zahawi, and who's kind of paid this penalty, paid this huge amount of tax. One can only assume that it is a sort of an issue of a lack of carefulness in some regard. Many people may well be deliberately dishonest on their tax returns for very much smaller sums of money, but it's not investigated, and in fact they get away with it, or benefit claims that are not entirely honest. At one level, that much smaller levels of dishonesty.
The principle's the same, isn't it?
The principle's the same. And actually, in some ways, the moral culpability of deliberate dishonesty, even at a much, much smaller level of amount of money, is in a way kind of more serious. And I think there is a danger of a kind of an institutional or sort of a cultural hypocrisy, that we rush to judgment of others but may well do things that are equally culpable. And in a sense, that's pharisaical. That's what Jesus put his fingers on.
There is a log in our eye.
I would just recommend everybody wears a seatbelt when putting something for social media as well. That would be my advice to leaders as we end this little segment. Our final story comes courtesy of one of our Twitter followers. The Vale of Mowbray pie factory in Leeming Bar collapsed into administration four months ago.
What?
But good news, pies could be manufactured there again as the site has now been sold. But I just wanted to get that in to link it to this story.
I'm a celiac. I'm completely disinterested.
You're not interested in pies.
No. So well, I am, but I've just got nothing about it.
You can't eat them. No, there we are. But it's a good link into this story, which is the government's working really hard to try and get people back to work.
They are.
So there are lots of gaps, lots of places where people need to hire folk to work in particular organisations. And we just thought it'd be worth talking about that because we value work highly as Christians, don't we? Yeah.
So, and the government have appointed a minister to work out how to get people back into work. So there are a large number of people who gave up work over COVID for various reasons and have not returned to work. And some of that's been put down to long COVID, but Mel Stride is the government minister who's been looking at this. And the basic line that the government is taking is that if we want to get the economy to grow over this coming year, we need to get some of these people back into work. And it's a very crude measure. We want to get people back into paid work.
Yeah.
And a lot of the job vacancies there are, I think 1.4 million, something like that, is it? A lot of the job vacancies there are in areas that people don't want to work in.
Mm.
So they are in low-level agriculture jobs, they're in social care, they're in the NHS. And these are very unattractive options to people at the moment. And I think there are some great lessons for us. I think we need to say, first of all, how much we highly we value work as believers.
But not just paid work.
Not just paid work. Mm. So we have a high view of the calling that God gives us. In every context, we don't split out the sacred and the secular. Mm. We believe that it's a high calling to care for children.
Yeah, parenting.
We believe it's
absolutely.
A high calling to care for elderly relatives or to be a carer at home.
Yeah.
So we do want to call out idleness, don't we? And Paul does that in 1 Thessalonians, and that's right to do. But we also want to be very generous and kind and caring to those who cannot work or who are working in unpaid environments. And I think actually one of the big narratives at the moment is there is a shift in the caring community towards people providing unpaid care.
Mm.
So people are looking after parents rather than wanting to see them in homes. People are looking after sick relatives relatives with failing health. And actually that's I think undervalued very often in society. And we need to recognize, I think in church life, that that too is a high calling. And as church leaders, we want to be caring for workers in the fullest breadth and saying, you're pursuing a very high calling that goes back to the garden, actually pre-formed.
And Johnson, a couple of high-profile figures who are stepping back from work, citing overwork, which has been interesting as well.
Yeah, with Jacinda Ardern in sort of New Zealand, stepping down as Prime Minister, obviously been an incredibly intense period of time. Yeah. And I think she said, I've just got nothing left in the tank. Mm. I've been working so hard. There's obviously been an immense amount of social media pressure sort of on her, all of the controversy over COVID. She says she wants to give more time to her children and kind of marry her partner. And at one level, I think that's quite a noble thing to recognise that the time has come to step back from work and intensity. We've seen, I think, a number of church pastors out of COVID recognising that maybe they've reached a point of burnout, exhaustion, and are unable to carry on. And one hopes and prays that after a period of a break, they will be restored and recovered and will be able to re-enter into work. But it certainly shouldn't be a matter of shame that because of the pressure that we experience, maybe in particular seasons of life, that there's a need to step back and to be able to recover, because you're not able to serve as effectively as you might. At the other end of the spectrum, Ken Bruce is leaving his program on BBC Two. I think he's
Radio 70, Two.
Radio Two. He's 73. He's been there for.
Is this the first time we've referenced Radio Two?
Oh, well, there we are. Taken 70 odd episodes.
Yeah. I mean, he's actually not stopping. I think he's on the Greatest Hits Radio or something like that.
Yeah, he's getting somewhere else. He's going to be paid double.
may well be the case, but you know. There's also a point when you've been in a role for a certain length of time and you're a certain age, there's a need for a change for the benefit of the kind of the organisation. Again, in churches, there comes a point at which leaders need to recognise that it's right for them to retire and give way for those who are younger, who will be able to connect with a broader and younger audience.
I'm really nervous, Phil, about attaching value to people's lives and their worth by what
they
earn.
Do and what they earn.
You know, actually the guy that comes and collects my bins is as valuable in society as someone who is paid 10 times as much as he is. And that's and I think there is a great disparity. We value people, we want to know what they earn, we value people by what they earn, and therefore they earn nothing if they're caring at home. Somehow that's not contributing to society in quite the same way. And I think we've got to get beyond that, and we've got to say, no, we value all people who are serving and living out the calling that God is giving them.
And I think part of the problem there is that kind of a collapse of a Christian worldview, really, from the Enlightenment, work ceased to be valued in the way that God values kind of work, good works and service. And basically the market became dominant. Mm. And so what happens is work is valued in accordance with scarcity, its economic productiveness and what profit it generates. And the result is a complete distortion of the value of what is worthwhile human activity. The market simply values things in a totally different way to the way that God kind of values things. And I think as a church, we need to kind of get back to a biblical evaluation. Can I make a pie comment?
Oh, thank please. You for your pie comment. Excellent.
There. Must you?
We live in...
Our Twitter follower is going to be delighted with this job.
One follower.
We live in Market Harbour and Leicestershire. And in kind of Leicestershire, it is in fact supposed to be traditional that what you eat for breakfast on Christmas Day is a pork pie. Other parts of the world and other countries would have different things. Actually, on Christmas Day, one of my daughters got up late, no time for breakfast, heading off to church. Ate a pork pie out of the fridge. And I thought, you have become a resident of Leicestershire, eating your pork pie.
It's time to replace the Pentagon logo of the FIC and replace it with a pork pie.
Well, this is fantastic. It really is another bombshell on which to finish. Worth saying, just going back to work and burnout, we've got a couple of... conferences coming up for our women in ministry, haven't we? Coming up, bookings open this week. So Thrive for women who are set apart by their church to do pastoral ministry amongst women. And then the Ministry Wives Retreat for those married to men in ministry. Bookings are open now on the website. Check those.
I'm also about to record some podcasts with Julian Gadsby from LICC, London Institute of Contemporary Christianity, about work.
Fantastic.
And about how we as leaders help workers in our church.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for tuning in to Independence, the FRAC podcast. This has been In the News with Adrian, John and myself, Phil. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll join you again
soon. Send in your pies.
Thank you.